Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines.
Hi, everybody. Cameron and Kevin with you as always, except no Cameron today. Cameron taking a much-deserved week off from the 170-something episode of the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast. So today, the guest is Mark Schatzker. And every week, we talk about food. We talk about issues with diet. We talk about trends and failures and different thoughts and philosophies around eating. But Mark Schatzker has written a new book called The End of Craving, The Lost Art of Eating Well. And this new book encapsulates many of the topics that we talk in and week out, and talks about our relationship with food. And the new book explores this combination of food, psychology, physiology, neurology, and how do cultural and historical feelings really shape our perceptions about food? And more importantly, how do these perceptions vary between cultures versus those that suffer from chronic issues of overconsumption like obesity, diabetes, if other food-related disorders, versus other cultures which still have a strong emphasis on food yet don't have the health-related issues? So thank you very much for joining us today, Mark.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's really nice to reconnect. It's been about probably 10 years or so since we really were able to talk about the Dorito Effect, your previous book, and cast a few lines in the Gulf of Mexico. That was kind of fun.
That was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, so I always like to follow up with your work because it brings new perspectives. And, you know, I read the news. I read a lot about food and health issues, diet issues. And we talk about them every week here on Science Facts and Fallacies. And really the punchline on this podcast always is that you really have to figure out what works for you and that there's no one size fits all. And that's kind of the thing I always resort to because I'm not a dietitian, but I understand that people are wrestling with these issues. This book for The End of Craving really does illuminate maybe what is at the central core of the problem. And that's what we'll talk about today. And it brings to light really the idea that we want more from food, we get less. And that here we are in a time of overabundance, a beautiful abundance, more choices than ever, safest food supply in human history, yet we have more health-related issues to food than we did at times of food scarcity. So let's start with the definition of the problem. What's wrong with health trends associated with eating, especially in the North American diet?
Well, it is that verb, eating. We are eating too much food. This has been a problem. It sort of really got going around the mid to late 70s, and nothing we can seem to do can stop it. You know, there was this war on fat in the 80s. Then we turned our gun sights on carbs. No matter what we seem to do, we seem to find a way to eat more. You know, we know that obesity is connected to all sorts of different kinds of disease, diabetes, various kinds of cancer and so forth. But more than anything, I think it's just a miserable state of affairs. We need to eat three times a day. Eating is meant to be a source of joy. It is meant to nourish us. And food has somehow become like a slow-acting poison. There's just something desperately wrong with the situation.
Well, you spend a lot of time with this as a center focus of the book that, you know, in the U.S., we look at this as the food being the enemy, where in places like Italy, it's abundant and people are eating gelato and having great desserts and enjoying wine and lots of really good meats, and they're not counting calories. So what are some of the differences that we see between the foods and the attitudes in North America versus a place like Italy?
Well, we're focused on nutrition in North America, and that's why we talk about things like carbs or fat or protein. We get obsessed with metabolism. We think maybe fasting can work. We talk about, eating like a Paleolithic diet. We're very analytical about it, and we tend to think of, nutrition from the neck down. How do nutrients interact with my body? We think that the act of eating is somehow dangerous. We say if it tastes good, spit it out. So we're kind of at war with our own nature. We think we got to conquer our inclinations that we were sort of crafted by evolution to want to eat ourselves to death. You go to Northern Italy, and I was stunned when I visited, but B, you know, just got the stats in Northern Italy. I can't believe we don't talk about it more. So the relationship with food in Northern Italy, it's like Alice in Wonderland. This is one of the arguably most delicious food environments in the world. It is a magnet for tourism. People go to Bologna just to eat what the locals are eating. And boy, do they care about quality. They have this repository of recipes, which is to say, if you're going to make lasagna or tortellini or any of these sacred dishes, you must do it this way. Their favorite noodle is called the tagliatelle noodle. It's a fresh pasta made with flour and eggs, carbs and fat. We've been lighting our hair on fire, screaming about carbs and fat for 20, 30 years. They combine them in these ethereal combinations. The food in Northern Italy, Bologna and that surrounding Emilia-Romagna, is absolutely stunningly delicious. Well, if deliciousness was the cause of the problem, you'd expect Northern Italians to be really fat, and they are really skinny. The rate of obesity there is less than 8%. Here, it's 42% the last time we checked, and we know it's gone up since the pandemic. So this is telling us something about how we frame this problem is totally wrong. These people are eating fantastically delicious food, and they're skinny. What is going on?
Yeah, and you have these two populations. You have North America, or even let's talk about the South, and Italy, or Northern Italy, where they have these delicious foods. And you talk about the disease, or the disorder, I should say, pellagra. And how did they identify what this was and this shared disorder between these two different populations? And eventually, how did it resolve?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And how we got to this, how I got to this was trying to figure out what was different about Northern Italy and us. What could explain this? But what I found back, when I look back in history, is that at one time, they were actually very similar to us. In fact, Northern Italy was very similar to the American South. Both were very poor. Both were agriculturally, agricultural economies quite backward. And both were suffering from this epidemic called pellagra. It started in Italy. In a dialect of Italian, it means rough skin. And that's how it started, with skin scales. And on the hand, it would spread. And then people would get demented. And they would get diarrhea. And then they'd die. And no one knew what the cause was. It's kind of like obesity in that there was always this rotating cast of experts that were sure they had it right. They would say it was things like spores that would get into the skin and catch fire, or had to do with how far you lived from a major body of water, or how much it rained, or it was carried by mosquitoes or sand flies. I mean, arguments, arguments, arguments. Well, in 1904, suddenly pellagra pops up in Georgia, and it becomes a pandemic, spreads from town to town. And again, all the experts think they know it, and they keep getting it wrong. Well, it was an epidemiologist, Joseph Goldberger, who figured it out. And everyone thought he was nuts, because he thought it had to do with food. So he descends on this sanatorium where there's this terrible outbreak of pellagra, and he says, don't clean a thing, don't wash the sheets. He changed the diet. He got them to, drink milk and eat beans and cheese, and everyone thought this guy's an idiot. And lo and behold, he wipes up pellagra. Still, nobody would listen to him. So he ends up creating pellagra in a group of prisoners at a prison. He said, he made a deal with the governor. If you let me sort of give them this weird diet and it works, can they go free? And the governor said yes. So he caused pellagra by feeding them grits, pork fat, and molasses. So eventually people realized this guy's got it right. And this was central to our understanding of nutrition, because this kind of opened the door to micronutrients. We realized that food isn't just food. There are essential elements within food that are necessary for the continuation of life. We call them vitamins. And what was the cause of pellagra was a deficiency of niacin, also called vitamin B3.
And this really leads to what to me was really an amazing part of the book. I never really thought about this before and have thought about it more since. And we'll talk about that maybe sometime. But one of the hypotheses that is proposed is that it was vitamin supplementation of flour and things like this, of foodstuffs, that in North America that led to the foundation of the obesity epidemic. And for me, at first, these were really hard dots to connect because it didn't make sense. How could vitamins be the culprit? But let's start out by talking about what are B vitamins and why did they matter in metabolism?
Well, so the first point I want to make is that our approach to vitamins, I think, is a little bit silly. We tend to think of vitamins as the forest elves of the nutrition world, that they are nothing but good. And the more we can have of them, the better. It's like fairy dust. If you just sprinkle the stuff inside your body, vitality ensues. It's just silly. It's not how it works. And like anything, It's a matter of context. There can be too little of something important. There can be too much of something important. So remember I talked about this diet that these Southerners were eating of grits, pork fat, and molasses? Think about that for a second. Carbs, fat, and sugar. And these people were starving because let me tell you, they were not fat. They were skinny, skinny, skinny. So how could they be eating this richly caloric diet and yet starving? And the reason is that we don't really understand calories. We think of calories as energy, the same way like you plug your computer into a wall socket to recharge, or you put gasoline into your car. We think calories are energy. On some level, that is true, but those calories are useless if we can't metabolize them. And we need micronutrients to metabolize calories, B vitamins in particular. So this is what explained pellagra. These people were eating an incredibly calorie-dense diet, but starving because you need niacin to convert calories into usable energy within the human body. Well, the approach in America to cure pellagra was to simply say, well, people need niacin. Well, let's give them niacin. And while we're at it, let's give them some other stuff too. Thiamine, riboflavin, iron. In the early 1940s, we passed laws to encourage, but effectively make law enrichment, which is to say we start to put in white bread, niacin, thiamine, riboflavin, iron, and then it drifted into all the other processed carbs, flour, it's in donuts, it's in breakfast cereal, it's in rice, it's in corn flour, and it worked really, really well. It got rid of pellagra overnight. It was gone. The interesting thing is over in Italy, they didn't do that. They said things like poor people should eat rabbits because it's cheap to raise rabbits, or they should bake bread in communal ovens. Some people even said poor people with pellagra should drink wine, which, I mean, it's kind of hilarious, but seems ridiculous. And yet, actually, not bad advice, because wine back then wasn't well filtered. It had a lot of yeast in it, and yeast is loaded with niacin. So they didn't really understand why, but it was actually good advice to tell someone with pellagra, drink a glass of vino. The thing about Italy that's neat is that their approach also worked. It took longer, but Italy literally ate their way out of a nutritional deficiency. What's so interesting on a kind of a metaphorical level, because I want to talk about the B vitamins, but I think the metaphor thing is interesting here because North America looked at food as the cause. And they said there's something wrong with food because it can be, it doesn't always have what you need. And there's something wrong with us because we don't know what we need. So we're going to go in there and we're going to use the hand of science to fix what's wrong with food because we're too dumb to know what's good for us. Over in Italy, they didn't see food as the cause. They said, well, food is clearly the cure. These poor people don't have access to good food. So they gave them access, and that worked. Their approach seems far less technologically savvy and kind of simplistic, has almost this peasant wisdom to it, and yet it worked. And I would say 100 years later, their approach to food, I think, is working better.
And it's such a perfect example. You know, here in North America, we have a problem and then we can take a bottle of riboflavin and a bottle of niacin off the shelf. And okay, if it's lacking, let's just put it in. Okay, cool. The other cultures that you would just expand the diet to include the things that correct the deficiency. And you're doing it more at physiologically relevant levels because it's coming from plant foods or plants or meat that have those nutrients available on those levels already. So you're not giving these massive overdoses to help release the potential energy that's involved in caloric intake. And I totally see how this hypothesis plays out, that it's not necessarily the number of calories, it's the ability to liberate the potential energy within those bonds that leads to the epidemics and obesity and everything else. But this was really supported. And when I should go back a second and say, I was just kind of curious about this because it seems like a hypothesis that should have some support in the literature. And it does. But you have to go back to the 1940s and experiments in pigs. And can you talk a little bit about those experiments at the University of Illinois?
Yeah, because this is where things get really interesting. In the pig farmers in the 1950s, like farmers today, they wanted to make money. And they knew the faster you can get your pigs big and fat and marketable, faster you can get them in and out the door, the more money you make. Well, they knew that there was like this rocket fuel feed you could feed your pigs, corn and soy. That would just make them put on the pounds. But they also knew if that's all you feed them, starts, you know, they start to gain weight at first and then they crater, they lose weight, they get diarrhea, their hair falls out. And the reason is that diet is not balanced. They didn't know why. They didn't understand vitamins. They knew you've got to balance the diet. You send your pigs out to pasture. All the pork back then was pastured pork. It was mainly alfalfa that they ate, but they needed green feed. If you wanted to, you know, confine your pigs in what they called dry lot, you had to bring them green feed. They didn't know what was in it, but they knew it was necessary. Well, the discovery of vitamins changed everything in pig farming. We talk a lot about CAFOs, confinement farming. None of that would have been possible without the discovery of vitamins, because here's what happened. They found that, hold on a second, with these vitamins, these B vitamins in particular, you don't have to give them the alfalfa. You can keep them fenced in. They're not moving around. They're staying still. They're not expending calories. You can give them this rocket fuel feed, but if you dust in the B vitamins, they don't crater. They just put on the weight. And this became the new paradigm of farming. There's pamphlets you can find from the 1950s saying there's a new way that you don't need to send your pigs out to pasture, that you can give them these B vitamins. And it makes sense, because remember we talked about what those poor farmers in the South were eating? Pork fat, grits, and molasses. That is an incredibly calorically dense diet. They didn't have the niacin to liberate those calories. Well, if you need niacin to liberate a tiny little amount of calories, the thinking goes, you also need niacin to liberate a whole ton of calories. And that's what the animal scientists found, that if you want to give them an incredibly calorically rich diet, give them the calories, also give them the B vitamins. Well, this changed pig farming. They talked about optimal weight gain. This got pigs big and fat faster than ever before. Well, we humans have this problem that we're getting bigger and fatter faster than ever before. And we did the same thing to our diet that we did to livestock diets, which is to say we eat an awful lot of processed carbs, a lot of fat too, and we dump in B vitamins. And it's not just enrichment. We have voluntary fortification. So we're dumping B vitamins to breakfast cereals. We're putting them in things like energy drinks, because people don't realize. They look at the nutritional info panel and moms go, well, look, this is loaded with vitamins. This must be healthy, right? Well, not so fast. Maybe this doesn't work the way we think. And maybe we need to think twice about this relationship between calories and vitamins and how we unlock the metabolic potential of these high calorie diets.
It's a really compelling hypothesis, because I think about how people I know eat, and they stare at that nutrition panel, and it's really a question of, well, there's too many carbs or too much sugar or, but it's loaded with B vitamins, you know, and it really frames the problem. And it's something like, you know, a box of Total cereal, which goes out there and says, we have 100% of the USRDA of all the stuff you need. And it doesn't necessarily taste good, you know, really frames the Italy versus US, argument again. Here we're consuming something that maybe isn't the best tasting or the best thing that we could reach for, but we're doing it because it's allegedly good for us. And then you combine that with the relative low toxicity of B vitamins, where people will say, eat, take as many B supplements as you want because you just pee them out anyway. And we're saturating ourselves with the catalyst that's necessary, or the cofactor that's necessary to liberate all the energy from the food we take in. It really is, it's really a compelling hypothesis. I really like that one.
Well, here's another interesting thing. We talk about all these empty calories that we eat, and that's actually, that can't be true. If we were just eating empty calories, we would get pellagra. If we were, so if you think about something like soda, like these fizzy sugary drinks, absolutely. There's not a lot of, you know, micronutrition happening. But what that means is if we're using the calories in all those sugary drinks, we must be getting the B vitamins from somewhere else. So we're supporting and we're enabling the caloric potential of these drinks by dumping niacin into so many other parts of our diet. Now, you can say, well, how does it work like with pigs or let's say with people in Italy? Well, obviously, they're getting in a natural diet, they're getting their niacin as well, but not in these concentrated forms. They have to eat things like vegetables, which have bulk, which are high in fiber, which just take up room in your stomach, and they just kind of change your, quote, foraging behavior. So we've just basically unintentionally designed a diet that is obesogenic. It is just high in calories and high in the vitamins that unlock the energy in those calories.
And there's that side then. So there's the side that we're taking in these calories and the cofactors to liberate the most energy from them, which eventually leads to weight gain. But there's also a physiological and maybe a neurological side to this too, that this is all happening on a tapestry with a set point. And I know I believe this because I've lost weight in my life, I've gained weight in my life, and I always kind of gravitate back to the same weight in the end. And you gave two very different examples of how we're metabolically tuned to be at a specific weight, either by caloric restriction or by, gorging and overabundance, and how neither approach changes weight permanently. And could you address those issues?
Yeah, and I'll just say, what a set point is generally, that's just the idea that there's sort of your brain keeps things at a certain level. So there's set points that we all understand. Body temperature is the best one. The human body is really good. The brain is really good at keeping our temperature at a certain temperature. When we get sick, we'll raise that temperature. That is the brain changing it. Your brain also controls things like heart rate. It basically decides, I'm setting it here. Well, body weight is the same way. Now, we don't approach it that way. We think it's all a matter of what I choose to eat. So I can choose to eat the cheeseburger, or I can choose to eat the salad. But diet culture tells us, in fact, that this is not true, because all diets fail. Now, we learned this a long time ago. There was the Minnesota starvation experiments. That was Ansel Keys before he did the Seven Countries study. He looked at what happens when people starve and they become absolutely obsessed with food. They become miserable. Their metabolism changes. We then discovered that if you take people who are overweight or obese and put them on a diet, it's a starvation response that ensues. It's a very, even though they're not starving, they respond as though they are starving. So you're thinking, okay, well, you're just confirming my suspicion that we're just calorie mongers. We just want to stuff our faces. But the opposite is also true. Since the 1950s, scientists have been doing overfeeding studies where they take people and instead of underfeeding them, they feed them way too much food. And I don't know why we never talk about this, because it is so fascinating. What happens? It turns out eating too much food is almost as miserable as being underfed. Ethan Sims was the first scientist who tried to do this, had to do it in a state prison because he couldn't get free living people to eat too much food. It's awful. Even prisoners would drop out. And then he found that after the study was done, people snapped back to their old weight. The pounds went away. There's a tribe in Africa called the Masa, and young men in this tribe, they prize having that buttery sheen of fat. So every year, the wealthy ones will undergo something called the Guruwala, where they sit alone in a tent and just gorge on the most calorically dense food they can find, a lot of sorghum porridge. It's crazy how much porridge they eat. They put on a fantastic amount of weight, 20, 25, 30, 35 pounds. They can't even get up without using a walking stick. And those pounds all just melt away. They would like nothing more than to stay fat, just the way so many of us would like nothing more than to be skinny. But it's not up to them. It's up to the brain.
As I mentioned before, I really understand this idea of a set point. I believe this is true. But is there a way you can control a set point?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question. Like we know, for example, with body temperature, like I mentioned, if we're under attack from a pathogen, the brain will raise body temperature. We know from certain animals, like if you look at bison, their set point changes in the winter. You can do that with gerbils too. When you change like daylight hours, their metabolism adjusts. So we know this can happen in other species. Does this happen with humans? Well, one thing that I became really interested in is the neuroscience of obesity. So one thing that is very different from what most people think that obesity is about indulging in too much pleasure, that people enjoy food too much. So what we see when we look at the neuroscience of obesity is that that's actually not the case. If anything, the people with obesity are enjoying food less. The pleasure response is blunted. What we see is that they want food more. When they see a milkshake or a picture of a pizza or the aroma of a cheeseburger, they are afflicted with a desire that is far greater than somebody of a more moderate body weight. So this to me says, okay, here's where we're seeing something different. Maybe this is how you adjust this set point over time, is by starting to monkey around with how much people want to eat food. So that kind of became the second question I was looking at in the book, which is, how could you take an intelligent brain that, you know, for up until about half a century ago was doing a really good job at keeping us at a certain weight, and how can you crank that up? And it's by making people want to eat too much food. So what is doing that? That's what I really started to wonder about.
Yeah, I really set up the argument for wanting versus liking. And I really appreciated this about this. I really appreciated this in the book. And you talked about some experiments that were done, and they were really kind of informal trials that were done with a scientist in Italy who studied obesity, who would say, here, taste this chocolate and tell me what you think about it. And then, you know, here's the whole box of chocolates. And maybe I'll let you talk about that rather than me. But what did you find when this idea of wanting versus liking, when we frame it in the terms of foods that are really desirable?
Yeah. So I think one of the things that we all need to do is get a better language around the pleasure of food, because we use this term delicious, but we use it in different ways. You know, we'll say something like a bag of Doritos is delicious. We'll also say something like one of those wonderful strawberries that you've bred at the University of Florida is delicious. It's a different experience though, because when you eat the Doritos, you just start to put one in your mouth and then the next one and then the next one and then the next one. When you eat a strawberry, I'd eat a bunch of those strawberries. They're fantastic. But you don't sort of stuff your face with them. It's a more immersive kind of a pleasure. This reflects some really interesting work that was done by a neuroscientist named Kent Berridge, who found that we talk about this neurotransmitter dopamine. Everybody thinks it's the pleasure neurotransmitter. It's not. It's the desire neurotransmitter, and it's really powerful. I mean, this is what we see as the problem with addiction, is too much dopamine. It makes us do stuff that we don't always enjoy doing. This is the nature of addiction, is a behavior we know to be negative that we can't seem to control ourselves with. Well, it turns out there's also this pleasure response that is mediated by the opioid neurotransmitters, and this is just the indulgence in the feeling of pleasure. And different foods tap into these two neural circuits. So I visited a scientist. It was actually in Germany. Her name is Anja Hilbert, and she uses what she calls hedonic therapy. This is pleasure therapy to treat people with binge eating disorder. And she let me take part in her therapy, and we started with a bag of chips, because she says chips are all about wanting. And it was a cheese and onion flavored. It was like a German brand. And she's like, open the bag. She's like, listen to the sound it makes. And there was this whoosh of aroma. And she's like, she let me take two potato chips out, and I could look at them and I could nibble them and sniff them. And then she said, rub them together, which I thought, like, what the hell, who rubs chips together? But it was unbelievable the effect it had on me. I was absolutely slammed with craving. I wanted nothing more than to eat these chips. And then she said, throw them in the garbage. I was like, are you nuts? I'm dying to eat these. I did. And then I took out two even newer, more pristine, wonderful chips. And I understood the power that these foods have over us. And it's so interesting because, you know, the thing about chips is like the bet you can't eat just one. When we start to eat them, the experience of eating potato chips is about the next chip. It's not what I would think of as an immersive, pleasurable experience. No one talks about, you know, I was in Singapore in 2003 and I'll never forget this bag of chips I had. We don't talk about a lot of these processed foods these ways. These foods engage this dopamine network of more, more, more. Well, then she gave me a very different food. This was a dark chocolate surrounding a biscuit center. And she said, now I just want you to pop this in your mouth and let the heat of your body melt it. And at first nothing happened. And then slowly it starts to melt. And then what a different food experience. Instead of being hopped up and anxious and thinking about more, all of a sudden I am like the passenger on this journey and the chocolate is taking me on a ride. And it was just incredible how much pleasure the single chocolate could deliver. Now, here's what is so interesting. Anja Hilbert uses liking to extinguish wanting. She'll have patients with binge eating disorder. And I mean, when these people binge, it's just unbelievable how many calories they will consume. And she says, when you get these cravings to binge, eat one of these fine, fine chocolates, just one. And what she finds is that a very fine chocolate can extinguish this desire for more. I met one of her patients who talked to me about the power of dark chocolate, how she said at first she didn't like it, but she grew to like it. Eventually she tried milk chocolate again. She said, oh my God, this stuff's way too sweet. And she said, here's the thing about dark chocolate. You can't overconsume it. It slows you down by its very nature. So I think this is important because it's opening this door and saying the experience we have with food, it's not just food. It's not just this sort of pleasure light that goes on. It's dynamic and interesting, and we have to develop a better vocabulary to talk about how different foods the effect that they have on us. And we have to realize that some foods are kind of designed to just make us eat, and other foods give us true lasting pleasure.
And maybe I can paraphrase this, take a shot at it, is that when you eat something that is like a dark chocolate and you allow the senses to connect with it, you are really savoring and extracting the qualities of it from sensory perspective that satisfies the and creates a liking that is that causes satisfaction versus the bag of Cool Ranch Doritos, which speak to a sensory circuit that directly engages the dopamine circuit, which is then just kind of fueling more, more, more. It's almost like separating the an emotional from a cognitive kind of eating. One which is an experience that's engaging the cerebral cortex, the other which is just shovel in more, much more of a evolutionary basic response.
Exactly it. I think it's a primitive eating network versus a more more evolved, more sophisticated and nuanced one. And listen, you know, desire is part of any good meal experience. If you and I, you know, that time we went fishing, well, if we sat down to have one of those great fish that we caught, of course you're going to desire it. You're going to have a bite and want to eat more. But there's going to be, it's going to be a more dynamic food experience than eating junk food. Because then that meal will also satiate us, and it will, the pleasure it provides, you're not just sitting there, you know, stuffing fish into your mouth. You eat slowly. One of the most interesting statistics I came across when researching this book is that Italians and also the French, they eat far fewer calories than Americans do. And yet it takes them twice as long to consume those calories. I mean, it almost doesn't make sense at first. And it makes you realize their meal experience, the way they eat is very different from ours. I think we eat in a more primitive way, that we're fixated on calories and we're just shoving them in our mouths. But that's not how humans need to be. There's another way of eating that I think we can unlock, and it's a much healthier relationship to have with food.
It's another interesting point, because I live on a farm. My wife farms, and we grow lots of fruits and vegetables, but things are always seasonal. And so we freeze and we save and we can, and we do a lot of things to put food away for later. And like the fish you mentioned, you know, if we're sat down with a fish meal that we just caught, we wouldn't eat every fish that we caught. We would save some for later because we knew it was a limited resource. And the fact that it was limited was another psychological overlay that said, while you got it, enjoy every bite because there's only so much of it there. Does that play into it too?
Yeah, there's that. But here's something else interesting. This ability to set food aside and have it later. You know, this whole idea that we come out of the womb and are just designed to stuff our faces. Well, if that was true, how would we have ever developed the willpower to say, I'm not going to eat this now. I need to save it for later. I think this is important because I think the fact that we misunderstand our own nature is part of the reason we can't snap out of this. And the other thing that's so interesting about fish and the fruit that you grow is that it never really tastes the same way twice. And what I think of as taste, as flavor, I think of as something very sophisticated going on in the brain. It's sort of calculation happening in real time, but you might enjoy the aroma, the flavor image of a great strawberry or blueberry or great tomato, but your brain is calculating going, is this good? And it's really only processed foods that always taste the same way twice. And that's something that's also very new in the food environment.
And it really ties in very nicely with my next thoughts about this, because we both know Howard Moskowitz. Dr. Moskowitz has been a pioneer in designing a lot of the different foods and flavors that we see in on store shelves. But it really started with his discussion in a paper in Science years ago, where he analyzed the association between liking and health. And this is a really fascinating study. Could you talk a little bit about the desire of the poorer workers in India and the consumption of a sour tamarind?
Yeah, so Howard was always interested, because he's a psychophysicist, in the basic taste, sour, sweet, salty, bitter, and then later umami joined the gang. And it had always been thought that these, you know, primary reinforcers, you just sort of came out of the womb, that we like sweet, we don't like bitter, we don't like sour, we like salty. And then he kind of heard that there was this population of illiterate laborers in southern India that really liked sour. So he teamed up with a scientist, Kamal Sharma, I think was his name, in Karnataka. He did an experiment looking at Indian medical students and also these illiterate laborers. And he basically gave them access to sugar water and also sour water, and it would be doses of increasing intensity. And what he found is with the sugar water, everybody was the same. We like progressively more sweet water until it hits the so-called bliss point, which is sort of like the limit, and then it becomes too sweet. So it turned out that these illiterate laborers were just like the Indian medical students, who were just like Western subjects. Sweet is good, more is better, until you hit a limit, and then it's done. But he found with sour that the Indian medical students, who came from, you know, wealthy families, their sour liking curve looked just like the American one or the European one, that we don't like sour, and I mean, a little bit's okay, but then it just gets worse and worse and worse, make it go away. These illiterate laborers, on the other hand, their liking for sour, the curve looked just like their liking for sweet. More is better, more, 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 more. And then it kind of hit this bliss point limit and that was done. Well, that kind of really went against what so many people thought about how basic tastes work, to the point that it was totally ignored. I think he published it in 1978. No one talked about it, I think, because it was just too inconvenient. How are we possibly going to explain this? Well, this got me interested in, well, why would these people like sour so much? And what I found was that Karnataka is a lot like Northern Italy and a lot like the American South. They eat too much jowar. This is essentially sorghum, very similar to corn, not a lot of niacin. And they would make it into a roti, and they would get these bouts of pellagra. Well, I started to look. There is this sour fruit that they love to eat called tamarind, and it is like super sour. The tamarind that grows in India is really, really sour compared to the sweet Thai tamarind that many of us know. Well, wouldn't you know it, lo and behold, tamarind's got a whole bunch of niacin in it. And isn't that interesting? Because that's the one thing they really need in their very jowar-heavy diet. And there they are sucking on this super sour tamarind fruit. But then I looked even more deeply, and it turns out they have this other terrible problem with fluoride. It's a very, it's like a desert region, not a lot of rainfall. So when water hits the ground, it soaks up all the minerals. They get way too much fluoride. We think of fluoride as being good. It makes your teeth, prevents cavities. But the problem with fluoride, when you get too much of it, it starts to screw up your mineral metabolism. You get these absolutely awful, hideous deformations. You get a brown pitted teeth, but then you get people with things like bamboo spine. I mean, it's just awful. Well, it also turns out when you start to look into the Indian scientific literature, that tamarind can actually reverse excessive fluoride in the diet. So if you're stuck in Karnataka eating this jowar heavy, fluoride heavy diet, the smartest thing you can do is eat this super sour fruit called tamarind. And wow, isn't it interesting that they love it, that somehow their bodies have understood this stuff is really good for me. I need to eat more of it.
It's really interesting that this happens, but do you think that it is, or does anyone know if, is this a cultural thing that you are born into this want for sour, or is this something that becomes hardwired genetically, that your DNA knows from selection of specific genes that that you need to have tamarind and to get the benefits of the anti-fluoride and also the niacin?
No, I think this is, we all have the capacity to learn. And what we're seeing is that the palate kind of adjusts in real time, that our desires and our joys become in line with what we need. So I, scoured, the records, everything I could find. And what we see when I became very interested in scurvy. And what we see when we look at scurvy, so this is the vitamin C deficiency that we studied in high school. And everybody remembers, if you remember scurvy, what they talked about was the swelling of the gums. Well, that absolutely happened. I mean, gums swelled hideously. All sorts of weird things happens. Like wounds that had been healed for decades would reopen. It became just incredibly painful just to touch a person's, even just their pajamas would make them howl in pain. But the first symptom of scurvy was a desire for fruits and vegetables, an intense desire. Sailors would look into the ocean and see heads of coral, and in their mind, these would transform into cabbages. They would wake up from dreams of eating fruits and vegetables, and then they would burst into tears when they realized that this was a dream. There was a ship that absolutely horrible case of scurvy. They're throwing bodies over every day. They wind up on Juan Fernandez Island, this island in the middle of the South Pacific. They scramble ashore, and they start eating moss and wild turnips. And they say how great they tasted. There's another story about this Irish nationalist, the British. They sent him over to Australia, and on the way across the Atlantic, They went that way, traveled west. This guy contracts or develops scurvy. And when they pull into port in Brazil, he buys 36 oranges and he eats six on the spot. And he says he will never forget the brutal rapture. So this is telling us that the reason we have this faculty of taste, the reason we sense stuff in food, is because our brain is smart and it knows what it needs. And when it gets into these deficient, messed up states, it knows what to eat to get out of those states.
That's really interesting, because I've heard things like this before about people craving chocolate at specific times because of, you know, copper deficiency or people who have pica, you know, where they're eating drywall, things like that, that they're having these urges that make zero sense that seem to be related to some sort of metabolic disorder. And this really, it's really an interesting phenomenology about listen to your body and your cravings in this case, which kind of is maybe a little bit different from the theme of the book, where the other theme of the book, which is be careful about what you're separating, what wanting is versus craving. Maybe is that a good takeaway?
Well, what I would say is that it tells us that the point of craving, the reason that it exists is good, because we are meant to be attracted to things that nourish us. I think modern food has messed this up. It's taken a very important bodily system, the motivation system, and turned it against ourselves, similar to the way drugs do it. I think the mechanism of action is different, but we find that it's a disordered relationship with food. But the reason we have this ability to crave is because it served a very good purpose in evolution, that when we really needed something, we wanted it really bad, and that made us get it.
And so how is that further thrown off by things like artificial sweeteners? But it's really important, because we have all of these options, like, you know, NutraSweet or these zero calorie sodas, that I've seen reports that say that switching from a sugar soda to a non-sugar, zero sugar, makes zero difference in weight gain. And is that tied in with this as well?
Yeah, so the RCTs on artificial sweeteners, they basically make it look as though they don't do anything, or if they do anything, it's just like they'll make you lose a tiny amount of weight. But the RCTs, you know, if you look at the observational data, you find that people who typically consume artificial sweeteners, way higher risk for obesity and metabolic disease. Is it reverse causation? It's very tricky, because sometimes you say, well, does an RCT really reflect a decision of a free living person? That's where things get interesting, because I think it's not a physiological response, it's a psychological response. So I'll expand on that, because remember how I said that we see people with obesity want food more? Well, I thought, well, what is it that's making people want food? Well, as we see from so much of the research about how people, when they start to crave fruits and vegetables, this tells, you know, when they have scurvy, this tells us that the sensory data from food isn't just this frivolous, meaningless data from the Stone Age. It tells us that it's really important. And there's a particular line of research from Yale University that I talked about in the book, where a professor named Dana Small, she was trying to see if it's possible to create beverages that really follow through on the promise of artificial sweeteners, which is to say they taste just as rewarding, fewer calories. This gets a bit technical, but I want to explain it because I think it's so interesting. What she did is she created five drinks that were all equally sweet. She used sucralose. They all taste like they have 75 calories worth of sugar. Then she uses maltodextrin, a flavorless starch, to give each drink a different calorie payload. So you got five drinks, all taste equally sweet, all have a different calorie payload. She gives these drinks to her subjects so that their brain gets accustomed to them, learns, and then she invites them to her lab and she scans their brain as they drink each of these drinks. Now let's just pause here for a second. What do you think those scans are going to show? Is the brain going to, you know, find all of these drinks equally rewarding because the brain just cares about sweetness and they were all equally sweet? Or is it going to be that really, you know, high calorie drink that the brain's going to go, oh, that's the one I want because the brain really likes calories? Well, it turns out the drink that got the brain response, like the only brain response, was the one that had 75 calories. Tasted like it had 75 calories, and it had 75 calories. She then found that this is the only drink that was actually being metabolized properly. So the lesson from that was that when sweetness and calories are not in sync, the brain doesn't know how to process them. It makes us understand that sweetness isn't a frivolous sensation of pleasure. It is information. And when this information is out of whack, it throws everything into disarray. Well, let's also say, well, what happens to a brain that starts to get fooled? Dana Small's research shows it doesn't get metabolized properly. But we can also look at the brain. A lot of scientists look at the brain as a prediction engine. This is the reason we sense stuff, is so we can predict, you know, why does the food taste the way it does? So my brain can predict what's coming into the gut so that it can metabolize it properly. Well, what happens when you start to fool that brain? Because this is really interesting. If you think about sweetness, this was stable. Throughout the history of our species, sweetness was a reliable indicator of calories. All of a sudden, we start to throw in stuff in the food environment that all of a sudden sweetness, you know, you used to think it was a 200 calorie hit. Now it's a zero. Now it's a 50. How does the brain respond to that? It turns out there's a robust body of literature in psychology. This is called uncertainty or reward prediction error. And when you fool a brain, what does the brain do? It goes, I want more. That might seem weird. Why would the brain respond this way? It makes perfect sense. Because in our evolutionary past, if something important became uncertain, you might get it, you might not. You had to work extra hard to get it. Our ancestors that worked harder to get it, got it. They're the ones that survived. So evolution didn't give us this desire to stuff our faces. What evolution gave us was this response to uncertainty. So now let's look at the food environment, because we have invented all these additives thinking they'll improve food, artificial sweeteners, fat replacers. Nobody talks about fat replacers. There's fat replacers in everything from mayonnaise to light yogurt to energy drinks, artificial flavors, natural flavors. If the sensory data has nutritional information, we have developed foods that are essentially designed to mislead the brain. And that causes uncertainty. And my hypothesis is that's what's making people want to eat too much food, because it's like the response that a gambling addict has. You double down. You want to work extra hard to get the thing that you want so badly.
Well, it makes so much sense. And prior to reading the book, I would have never have guessed that these things were true. And so if we really wanted to put a cap on this and really just kind of blend everything together, take into consideration everything we've learned about the psychology around food versus these cultural differences, how do we change how we think about food to have a much more healthy relationship with it?
Well, the first thing is we have to stop thinking about nutrition from the neck down, that nutrition is about how nutrients interact with our physiology. Does that happen? Absolutely. We need to start thinking of eating as a behavior. This is more a question, I believe, of psychology that has physiological consequences. So we have to think about what it is that's motivating people to eat too much food. When people say, well, what should I do? I'll tell them what everybody says, what Michael Pollan and the gang all say, eat real food. But I will add this, eat like an Italian. Eating well, eating good food that nourishes you isn't some kind of act of penance, of misery that you force upon yourself. Eating should be a joyful occasion in which you nourish your body the way it was meant to be nourished. It's possible. Northern Italy and also cultures like Japan and France and South Korea tell us it is possible to have a wonderfully pleasurable, satiating relationship with food that is not negative, it's positive. So I think there's a lot of glimmers of light. We just need to reframe the problem.
Well, grazie mille to that one. I really just find this so interesting, because it's things I never really thought about much before, but the book really helped me understand my own habits and my relationship with food, and really helped me understand how other people are thinking about it. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today. So thanks a lot, Mark.
No, it's great to chat. I enjoyed it tremendously. Thank you so much for having me.
And at the end of this podcast, Cameron and I always talk about who we follow on Twitter, because we try to give folks a little bit of advice as to who are the good accounts that you might want to follow. So do you have a favorite one that you follow when you're in that environment?
Oh, that's interesting. You know, I follow a bunch of scientists. Many of them, you know, aren't like really well known. They're well known in the world of science, but not well known popularly. But what that does is it kicks in the Twitter algorithm that I'll get often just a lot of threads from scientists explaining this or that finding. So I often, you know, I'll forget the name of the scientist, but I'll get exposed to some really interesting threads. So that would be my advice, would be to follow a bunch of scientists. And that's one way you can actually make the Twitter algorithm, the evil algorithm, you know, do a little bit of good.
Yeah, I agree on that one. I really like following different scientists because it saves me a lot of time reading tables of contents, which is what I used to do. Now I just read Twitter. Person who I follow and I always get a lot from, and I just throw out mine, is Kara Santa Maria, and she's a co-host of Skeptic's Guide to the Universe and also someone who's done a lot of great work in media, and she's at Kara Santa Maria, so that's my pick for the week. But thanks again, Mark, for joining me. I really appreciate it. And for everyone listening, thank you very much for listening. And listen to us again next week when Cameron returns to the Science, Facts, and Fallacies podcast. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next week.